Before we started, we had a coin flip. Governor Kitzhaber won the coin flip and elected to go first. Governor, the floor is yours.
Thank you. When I took office in January 2011, Oregon was a polarized state facing high unemployment, a $3.5 billion budget gap, a divided legislature, and an uncertain future. The cost of health care, public safety, and our retirement system had locked Oregon's finances into a downward spiral, and partisan gridlock made it difficult to move forward on the basic priorities for Oregon's future. I laid out a plan to address those costs, to put Oregonians back to work, and to get our state back on track, and I laid out how to do it. The only way to address these issues was to cross the partisan divide. We could not allow these daunting issues to tear us apart as we'd seen in some states like Wisconsin. And what we've done together over the past 4 years is to create that political operational center that was once a hallmark of our state, one that allows us to act together as a community and move forward for the benefit of all of us. Together, we've taken on these difficult challenges, and together, we have succeeded. Legislators of both parties, labor, business, and community leaders from both urban and rural Oregon have pulled together to put Oregonians back to work and put our state on the path to a more sustainable future. We closed the budget gap without partisan rancor. We've helped small businesses grow and expand. We've created 100,000 new jobs and reduced the state's unemployment rate by over 3 points. Our health care, public safety, and PERS retirement initiatives passed with bipartisan majorities, saving taxpayers hundreds of millions of dollars today and freeing up resources for a long-term reinvestment in children, families, and education. We've hired more teachers and added school days while demanding accountability at all levels to ensure that by 2025, each student graduates from high school and 80% of them move on to get a post-secondary degree or certificate. We've reopened the last timber mill in Josephine County, secured unprecedented water agreements in the Klamath and Mid-Columbia. We've kept our small ports open and found new markets for Oregon agricultural products. We've secured major new investments from Nike, Intel, and Daimler to expand their Oregon operation and create high-wage jobs. And despite what some may say about the I-5 bridge replacement, we fought the right fight to streamline that project to address key safety, traffic, and economic concerns, and we delivered our end of the bargain. We've also taken on out-of-control medical inflation. And while I look forward to discussing Cover Oregon today, I also want to discuss the fact that 1 million Oregonians are now in a new care model that's providing better outcomes at a lower cost, saving taxpayers $200 million in the next biennium, $400 million in the 2017-19 biennium, and $600 million a biennium after that. We are making good on our promise and commitment to ensure access to quality, affordable health care for all Oregonians. But the common thread that runs through these accomplishments is that we did them together, and we're not done. Over the next 4 years, we have an extraordinary opportunity to build on these achievements and make a profound difference for our future. I look forward to discussing that future with you this morning. Thank you.
Representative Richardson, sir.
Thank you. Today you're going to hear two very different paths for the future of our state. This isn't about a Republican versus a Democrat. It's about the past versus the future. Governor Kitzhaber must explain to all of us his third-term failures. Cover Oregon, $300 million wasted. The CRC, $190 million wasted. The Department of Human Services Modernization Project, $71 million wasted. By contrast, I'm here to present a vision for turning on Oregon's prosperity engine, to drive a healthy economy, and to bring world-class education back to the state of Oregon. I believe being governor is a full-time job. As a senior legislator, I earned a reputation as being a thoughtful and hardworking budget hawk. I got to the Capitol early, I stayed late, and I worked across the aisle to get things done. The first principle of leadership is showing up. For 3 years, the governor has been missing in action, and you know it. I mean, he's rarely available to you for comments when you have an important story for your readers. He spends a quarter of his time only in Salem, three quarters up in Portland or wherever. In 10 and a half months, he took 7 weeks of vacation. The governor is not tuned into governing. He's not paying attention, and his list of failures proves it. I grew up a son of a carpenter, a union journeyman, who taught me the value of hard work and attention to detail. As a helicopter pilot in Vietnam, responsibility and accountability kept me and my crew alive. When I got back from the war, I got my life in order, found and married a wonderful girl, Kathy, who's here. We're celebrating our 41st anniversary this month. and we enlisted in the most important job of our lives, being parents. As a father, I can tell you this. When you have 9 children, you get used to hearing excuses and blame. So when the governor's excuses and blaming for the Cover Oregon abject failure and tremendous waste of taxpayer dollars, when they came forward, it wasn't a surprise to me. Now, we need a governor who understands Oregon's public education system. I mean, as a parent of 9 kids, all who graduated from public schools, I can tell you that we were engaged and we understand the education system. We don't have to accept mediocrity in education any longer. Oregon's future can be bright, but we need a full-time governor who's dedicated to getting the job done, who will work hard, who will pay attention to detail, and who will be a governor of, by, and for the people he serves. I'm here to restore faith in the state government and provide the leadership Oregon desperately needs. I know what it's like to be poor. As a young couple, we were in a situation where we couldn't even afford to have more than 1 tank of gas. I know what it's like to be unemployed, to have a child with special needs, to adopt a child, to give love and hope that adopt a child needs. I know what Oregon families are going through, and as governor, I can help.
Our first question comes from Dave Baker of the Register Guard. Representative Richardson, you answer first.
2 states have recently passed marijuana legalization measures. Some believe that Oregon will be the next state to do so. Do you favor legalization of marijuana? If not, why? And if so, what kind of limitations would you want to see in a legalization effort or measure?
On this, the whole marijuana issue is going to be decided by the people. I would prefer if Oregon would wait a year so that we could watch what comes down in Washington and Colorado, learn from the things that they're doing right and the mistakes that they're making, rather than just diving in. It's going to be determined by the voters. As governor, I will take an oath to uphold and support and enforce the laws of this state, and I'll keep that promise. I'm not going to change my mind after I get elected on issues that I may not agree with.
Yeah, I think the question was whether you support or oppose the ballot measure. I will answer that. I'm not going to vote for it at this point in time, and it's not because I have any problem with marijuana. I would argue that alcohol probably does more morbidity and mortality to society than marijuana. But I do agree with my opponent that I think that we do have 2 models, Colorado and Washington, and we need to look very, very carefully at the implications of those 2 measures. I believe that the legalization of marijuana is inevitable in the state, and I think it's very, very important that we get ahead of that and put in place a clear framework that addresses public safety issues, taxation issues, public safety issues, and make sure that that is well thought out in advance. If this measure passes, and I believe, correct me if I'm wrong, the one that qualified is the statutory measure, I will certainly work to ensure that we have that kind of framework.
Second question from Therese Bottomley of the Oregonian. Governor, you answer first.
Given the millions of dollars spent on the Columbia River crossing in Cover, Oregon, what 3 things will you do to restore trust that taxpayers can be assured the state is using their money wisely? Please be specific.
Certainly. Let's start with Cover Oregon. We can go down the rabbit hole of warning signs that might have been there and whether or not they were addressed. But the fact is we were all getting the same information, the legislature, my office, the Legislative Oversight Committee, Cover Oregon Board, and the federal government, and we were assured repeatedly that this was going to launch on time. It didn't. My responsibility was to fix that, which I have. We have removed and held accountable those individuals in Cover Oregon and the health authority who made the decisions that led to the failure to roll out a functional website. And now I am seeking damages from Oracle for the technology that they provided to us. But during that time, we never took our eye off the ball, which was to enroll Oregonians in health care. We've enrolled 300,000 people through the exchange, many of those people who never had health insurance coverage before. I just don't accept the premise that all those dollars were wasted. We enrolled 300,000 people. That money wasn't wasted because we enrolled 300,000 people. The fact is, though, that because we didn't have a fully functional website, it cost more per person, and those are the resources. It's that delta that we're going to try to recover from Oracle. I make no apologies about the CRC. No one, including my opponent, said, well, we shouldn't do the design work. We shouldn't go after the EIS. We shouldn't get the Coast Guard permit because there's an outside chance that Washington State, that has worked on this for a decade, won't uphold its end of the bargain. The problem remains. We had to call the question. We had to do all we could to deal with an infrastructure issue that has a huge impact on our economy. And I appreciate Representative Richardson's support for moving the project forward when the legislature appropriated the $400 million for Oregon's share.
Representative Richardson?
Okay, you've asked for three things. What I would do, first, I would listen and pay attention. On Cover Oregon, I had the opportunity to send letters warning the governor over a year before the failed launch date that Cover Oregon was going to fail unless he paid attention to the quality assurance team that we'd hired to oversee the project. They were saying it's in jeopardy. He ignored that. I think we should listen to the warnings. The second thing is that we should pay attention to what the legislature says and not think that we can just go it alone. A perfect example of being aloof and detached was the governor's desire to go alone on the project, to have Oregon utilize its resources and go forward with the Columbia River Crossing Bridge, even though the legislature had made it clear that the representatives of the people were not going to go it alone. We were not going to go forward unless we had equal participation from the state of Washington. That kind of decision or arrogance, I believe, when you say, I know what's better than the representatives of the people and we're going to go forward, I think that's a mistake. So we need to pay attention to the legislature because that's 90 representatives of the people. And the third thing is that we need to learn from other projects. There are bridges being built in other states where they've had failures at a fraction of the cost of what was being anticipated for Cover Oregon. That was a project. We would be building a bridge now if it wasn't for the light rail portion of that. We shouldn't have philosophical issues interfere with our goal of trying to have outcomes, which with a bridge project, of course, is lessening our congestion, moving commerce and consumers across the bridge. And so anyway, we need to make sure that we learn from others and their successes and their failures.
Next question from Carrie Borgen from the Observer and the Baker City Herald. Representative Richardson, you answer this one first.
Rural Oregon has not participated in the economic recovery to the degree that Metro Oregon has participated. Why do you think the recovery lags in rural Oregon, and what would you do as governor to address that?
I think that we need a governor who represents all of Oregon and not just the I-5 corridor from Eugene North. I've traveled to all 36 counties. In the last 11 months, I've talked to people who feel disenfranchised. They feel like nobody pays attention to them, whether it's on the coast or in southern or eastern Oregon. We had one situation where a man was asked, how do you feel about what things are going? And he's a big guy, and he starts tearing up. He said, I lost my job. I don't know where I'm going to get another one. We need a governor who will unify our state, no longer allow this urban versus rural divide to take place. We're all Oregonians, and as governor, we need to have the effort and the attitude that unifies all of our people. When one area of Oregon is suffering, it affects all of our state.
Governor?
Well, I think there's no question that rural Oregon, as well as many communities of color, have lagged behind in our economic development. And I think part of the problem is that we have not been able to sort of change the business model of our natural resource-based economy. We're still operating on the way we wish it was back in the 1980s, but that's changing. We've got forest collaboratives in your part of the state that are actually putting people back to work in the woods. I was in La Grande and Wallawa about 2 weeks ago going through the Boise Cascade plant there in La Grande, and then the integrated biomass plant in Wallawa. And they've got a new business model that essentially is extracting every dollar of value out of those smaller logs. So they've adapted to the fact that we have smaller logs, and we're actually going to be able to take that to scale. We've also been working to expand water out of the Columbia for expanding irrigated agriculture in that part of the state. We actually took action to keep the last limp timber mill in John Day open. We've kept the last timber mill in your district open down in Cave Junction, which wouldn't have happened otherwise. So we've got a deep commitment to rural Oregon. We've been able to secure dollars to dredge our small ports, which are absolutely essential, and we'll continue to do that. So the answer is to essentially try to figure out how you can pump up your natural resource industries in a way that actually reflects the realities of the 21st century, We also need to recognize that there's a land base issue. 75% of farmland in Oregon is going to change hands in the next 15 years. We need to make sure that that doesn't snap up for development, just like we want to make sure we have working forests as well. So I'm actually optimistic. There's no question that we have a long way to go, but there are very good things happening out there. And you ask the folks who are going to be going back to work in Cave Junction this summer, 67 family wage jobs that would have been lost if we hadn't leaned into that and expressed a deep concern about what's going on in rural Oregon, and I will continue to do that.
Next question comes from Larry Campbell of Coos Bay, and Governor, you answer first.
Thank you. Taxing entities surrounding Coos Bay are devising a plan that would grant the Jordan Cove Energy Project a long-term tax abatement in exchange for donations beginning immediately upon construction, if construction begins, obviously. Now, those payments, now estimated at about $12 million annually, would be given not as tax revenues, but given to a nonprofit corporation established specifically to avoid revenues being considered under the state's school funding equalization formula. What effect do you think this plan might have on education funding statewide? And is a plan like this, specifically designed to sidestep state funding mechanisms, a viable alternative for other taxing entities around the state?
My first?
Yep.
Yeah, well, I understand the rationale behind it, but I do have some real concerns about that as a precedent. And, you know, the real issue is making sure that we have adequate resources in the state school fund to provide adequate resources for our schools. Seems to be the real answer to this. It's not unlike the challenge in the ONC counties, of which you are also one, is increasing the job base, because increasing the job base increases the local revenues. So I think I'll wait till we actually get the Jordan Cove question, but I think just as in the ONC counties, the answer is not the federal payments. And I don't think the answer is trying to create Byzantine ways to raffle away money that might otherwise go to the education fund. It's to figure out how we can actually begin to lift up our rural economies. And that means trying to, as I said earlier in the earlier question, figuring out what the business model looks like and I think we're doing it on the west side, east side. It's a little more challenging on the west side because they're different. They're moist forests. It's a different kind of forest. There's not as much opportunity to thinning. But that isn't to say that we can't do it. So I'm a little skeptical of that. I'm sympathetic to the purpose, but I think we really need to be focusing on creating a better job base in rural Oregon if we want to solve the problem long term.
Representative Richardson, and then you can follow up, Larry. Representative Richardson.
The question is about $12 million being set aside to try and promote that project. $12 million, if it would enable the project to go forward and boom, it would create a boom in the economy for Coos Bay, then it'd be worthwhile. We need to make sure that it doesn't just become another situation where you're picking winners and losers with taxpayer dollars, and then there's another failure that the taxpayers have to pay for. I'm pleased to see the governor's concerned about finding out what it's like with the depressed economy over in Coos Bay. I would think after three terms that maybe he'd already know. In the last month, Oregon has lost 4,300 jobs. Some of those are in Coos County. There's been 288,000 job increase nationally. We are bumping along with high unemployment, and it's no longer, we just can't accept this. It's been over 17 years that we've had employment that's higher than unemployment, higher than the national average in Oregon. When is that going to change? If you want to have a booming economy, if you want to have funding for the schools, you need to have more people working. We need more taxpayers and not more excuses as to what we're going to do in the future.
Larry, follow-up question for both candidates.
Since you both seem to have doubts about this mechanism, as governor, would you actively try to block it then?
Governor?
Yeah, no, I wouldn't. I mean, I think there's there's a real problem, not just in Coos County, you know, particularly in southwest Oregon. There's a public safety problem that's probably even much deeper than the school problem. And there's no immediate answer to that, right? So I guess what I will continue to do is work to try to amp up both the natural resource base and the diversification of our rural economies, because ultimately I think that's what's going to bring the real stability. And you know, Coos County is very hard hit. You know, it's when I was in Douglas County, actually represented that area for a long time, and have seen what happens when, you know, proud people suddenly can't provide for themselves anymore. I've seen the consequences in the ER. So it is true. It is a true tragedy. But we've got a good active regional solutions team down there. We're developing some, I think, very fruitful opportunities for economic growth and job development in that troubled part of the state.
Representative?
I agree with the governor that we need to go forward with it and take a look and see how it works out. We need innovation, but we need a governor who will pay attention to how it works out. It's not enough just to say, let's go forward and then go to Bhutan. I mean, what we need is a governor who will pay attention, who will have the right people in the right place to make sure that the assets of the people are being well used, and this we ought to seriously look at.
Our next question is from Peter Wong of the Portland Tribune. Representative, you answer first.
Now that the subject of education funding has been brought up, I assume that if you still agree with the state goal of moving, having everyone graduate by high school by 2025 and 80% of those moving on to some form of post-secondary education, and I believe Representative Richardson, you voted for that bill and Governor Kitzhaber signed it, how will you continue moving toward that goal and paying for it? If you don't agree with it any longer, how would you? What alternative would you propose to increase academic achievement?
We've got a challenge. I mean, the whole idea of 40-40-20 assumes that there's going to be 100% graduation rate, and everybody wants to see the graduation rate get better. I mean, we're 49th in the nation. I used to say only 48th, but guess what? We're now 49th in the nation in graduation rate. That means only one state has a worse statistic for us than in how many seniors they're graduating with their classmates. I believe that we need to make major changes. Right now, one of the things that is coming in that's going to affect the funding is Common Core. It's going to cost $187 million to implement a program that's sent to us by the federal government by non-educators. The governor supports Common Core. I oppose it. I oppose any program that we're sent from the governor, from the federal government that hasn't had input from parents and teachers. All we're doing now is changing our teachers into class monitors, and they're in and they're having to teach to a test that hasn't been adequately vetted. As far as the finance is concerned, we need to have equal educational opportunity for all of our students. That's going to require changing some of the ways that we handle the money. I believe that we should have the funds follow the student if that and not have a child's future be determined by the zip code that their parents happen to live in. We cannot afford to lose another generation. We have to make changes, and the standard ideas of just more of the same are not meeting our needs.
Governor?
Yeah, I think the most important thing we've done is align governance, policy, and funding across the entire continuum from early childhood to post-secondary education and training, and develop a model where the purpose is not funding institutions but funding the success of students as they move along the continuum. That's got to start early because an awful lot of kids, particularly kids from generational poverty, kids from communities of color, English language learners, arrive at school with a huge achievement gap, and they often never catch up. And that's one of the big drivers of our dropout rate. So we've retooled our entire early learning program. We've made it performance-based. We're rolling out early learning hubs that essentially are designed to make sure that kids are, A, ready to learn when they get to kindergarten. We've instituted for the first time a kindergarten readiness assessment. And we are focusing and have targeted resources for third-grade reading because third-grade reading is probably the most powerful metric in terms of later success. We've also got targeted investments to connect kids with the workplace. Everyone's not going to get a BS, right? So we've got CTE and we've got STEM, and we're helping kids learn earn college credits in high school. I was out in the Grand and Pendleton a couple weeks ago. Actually, I do get out of Portland occasionally. And looked at the Oregon Promise, which actually, or the Eastern Promise, which is a wonderful program that we're trying to scale up across the state to actually get kids connected, both through high school, but to see the world of work beyond high school. I think that one of the challenges that we're going to continue to have is the funding issue. I do think there are huge opportunities for reinvestment of resources from the savings we're generating in healthcare. We have now rolled that care model I've described to you from Medicaid into the private sector with 130,000 state employees. And if we do that with the Oregon education, with the school teachers, the potential savings for the 17-19 biennium are about $820 million, $1.3 billion for 17-19. So there is a way to get money into the system, but it has to be a different system. It has to be student-focused. It has to be outcome-focused. And you have to recognize where the key investment points are that will leverage the greatest return on those dollars.
Our next question from Dave Baker. Governor, you answer first.
There have been several high-profile incidents of sexual assault reported on college campuses across the country. Some people believe it's becoming an epidemic, and obviously the University of Oregon's had its own issues. What do you think we can do or should do to address this issue?
My first on this one?
Yeah.
First, we should have zero tolerance to sexual assault and sexual harassment, not just on universities, but throughout the state, but particularly universities where we have young people, impressionable people who are often away from home for the first time. There should be zero tolerance. And I think that the university presidents need to take the lead on that. They need to be vocal in articulating that zero tolerance level, and they need to develop policies with teeth in them to implement the zero tolerance policy.
Representative?
You know, I can't add anything to that. I agree with what the governor says. There is no tolerance for this. It's an issue that is a plague across the country, and we can learn from other jurisdictions. I think the one thing we do is that we partner with other jurisdictions, get together, and decide what is working. Where are there universities that have a reduction in their sexual assault programs, and let's learn from them. I firmly believe that every problem that Oregon faces is being successfully solved somewhere, that we do not need to start with a blank piece of paper. We can learn from the successes and the failures of other communities, other universities, and implement the things that are best practices in Oregon.
Therese Bottomley has our next question, and Representative, you answer first.
So what now for an I-5 bridge into Washington State? What should be our infrastructure priorities in the wake of the CRC?
Okay. One of the fundamental responsibilities of government is infrastructure. I mean, if we had to work through the current maze of problems and bureaucracy that we have in Oregon today, we wouldn't have I-5. But what we need to do as far as a new bridge, and we have a bridge that part of it is 100 years old, the other one is over 50 years old, there has to be a plan for replacing bridges when it's such an important part of our network of commerce and, you know, and transportation. I believe that we need to get together and focus on the outcomes. It's not about should we foist light rail onto Vancouver. That's not the issue. The issue is, what do you want from a bridge? We want safety. We want to reduce congestion. We want convenience. And we need to approach a new bridge with that in mind. Does it mean a third bridge, you know, where you have an additional bridge kind of extends the belt loop? That should be considered. Are we going to just go forward with the plan that was already failed on the first, you know, in the first attempt? We've spent over 15 years on the CRC project, $190 million, and not a single shovel of dirt was ever moved. That kind of planning we can't afford. Let's focus on the outcomes that we want. We need to work closely from the beginning with the legislatures in both Oregon and in Washington. That was not done before. If it wasn't for Representative Cliff Bintz, we would have been waiting to hear about the CRC until the time that they came to ask for money. The legislature was not part of the discussion of the CRC for nearly a decade. We need to have the legislature, the representatives of the people, be involved from both Washington and from Oregon at the outset, and that way we will get a new bridge.
Governor?
Well, actually, Speaker Hanna was intimately involved in the CRC and representative voted for it, so I'm not quite sure where that goes. What he failed to address is the elephant in the living room, is how you pay for this infrastructure. It's nice to talk about it, but at the end of the day, we have to pay for it. You know, we had $850 million from the Highway Transit Fund, Federal Transit Fund, plus another $400 million. So we had $1 billion of resources, which has now gone away. So the question really is, how do you finance, whether it's the CRC or other projects? I know that the Transportation Coalition will be bringing probably a funding mechanism into 215 based on the gas tax, which I will certainly support. But I think if the only question we ask is how can we increase the gas tax, we're asking the wrong question, because the gas tax is not the financing tool of the future, because cars are more efficient and people are driving less. So we have to me, the answer is trying to figure out how you get some of the private capital that's sitting on the sidelines to come in and support public infrastructure projects. Partnerships BC is a great example of where they've done $10 billion worth of public projects using private resources. We've created about 2 years ago something called the West Coast Infrastructure Exchange, which is a partnership between Oregon, Washington, California, and British Columbia, to try to do just that, try to figure out a standard term sheet to get smaller transportation projects and bundle them up to a size that will be of interest to institutional capital. And I just met yesterday with Secretary Vilsack, the Secretary of Agriculture, on other infrastructure opportunities on water projects. So I think that the real question is funding. Let me simply say about the CRC is that problem has not gone away. That bridge is the lifeblood and artery for every product in Oregon that's exported to the world economy, and we are the most trade-dependent state in the nation. So let's not gloss over the fact that that problem still remains. It's a safety problem and it's an economic problem, but leadership requires not just pointing to the problem, it's about figuring out how to pay for it, and as I mentioned, we've got a couple of very robust opportunities for increasing the ability to finance infrastructure here in Oregon and along the West Coast.
Our next question is from Terry Bor- follow-up.
Quick follow-up. Given that transportation involves more than highways and bridges, what solutions in terms of funding would you embrace to address the needs of the entire transportation system in Oregon?
Representative, you go first. A minute answer here.
Thank you. It's a great question because the CRC, where all the focus was, if we'd gone forward with the governor's go-it-alone plan, would have consumed all of the available capital or debt capacity that we would have had in this state for another 10 years because we would be going it alone. What we need to do is identify all across the state that there needs to be long-term planning for infrastructure. I believe that we should have a freeway from Coos Bay to Burns to Ontario. Why wouldn't we want to have an east-west connection? And that takes 20 years of planning for us to do that, because that's a partnership between the state and the federal government. But without vision, the people perish. Without vision, our infrastructure stays the same, gets more and more congested, and we end up having continued depression on the coast where we have deep water ports, and in eastern Oregon where it's so difficult and expensive to get products to market.
Governor, a minute.
Let me just correct the record. At no point was Oregon at risk for more than the $400 million that the representative voted for. At any point in the CRC discussion. I have a group that I put together chaired by Greg Cantor of Northwest Natural Gas and former Republican Speaker Larry Campbell to essentially ask the question, what do we want our transportation system to look like across all modes, which includes bikes, peds, marine, aviation, service transportation by 2025, and then ask ourselves, then how are we going to pay for that, right? So we need to begin to ask a series of much broader questions about transportation infrastructure. It's not just roads. Almost everything that moves out of the state to the global economy is intermodal. It's rail. It's marine. It's aviation. And so we have to actually be able to quantify what we want that transportation to look like and then begin to ask ourselves what the funding options are. And again, I don't believe we can rely on the United States Congress for the kind of funding that we've relied on in the past. They can't even keep the Highway Trust Fund going. So we have to be creative and figure out how to get some of the private capital on the sidelines in partnership with public resources to fund these infrastructure projects.
Our next question is from Kerry Borgen. And Governor, you answer first on this one.
Over half of Oregon's land is owned and managed by the federal government. There's been discussion and proposals proposed in other states that would return the management of the federal lands to state control. So what do you think Oregon's role should be in the management of federal land?
I don't think the federal government is going to go there. It might be nice, but I think we've got to be realistic. We're approaching something called an all-lands approach, which is basically beginning to look at the forested landscape in Oregon and ask ourselves, how should it be managed across ownership boundaries? That is, the trees on a piece of private land right next to a piece of tribal land right next to a piece of state land or federal land are pretty much the same trees, and we have completely different various different management protocols. We're trying to test that on the ONC lands. I just had a call with Representative Fazio and Senator Wyden about the bill on Friday, so we're optimistic that we're going to be able to move something in that direction. But I think we need significant reform of the U.S. Forest Service. I'm the incoming chair of the Western Governors Association. That's going to be one of the issues that we're going to look at, not just in Oregon, but across the West. And I think we have to figure out a way to streamline the NEPA process, not undermine it, but to recognize that it has become, I think, an obstacle to actual responsible management of our forests. So I do think there's a lot that the state can do. We're in partnership right now with the federal government on what we call SageCon, which is trying to address, as you're very well aware, the conservation of the sage-grouse, but while still ensuring that we can have a robust rural economy. That's one of the reasons I met with Secretary Vilsack yesterday. So we need to be realistic. I don't think the feds are going to hand over control of federal lands, but I do think there's an awful lot we can do in partnership with the Western Governors Association and with the federal agencies by having a different conversation and trying to change sort of our view of forest management. And again, I believe it has to be an all-lands approach that gets us out of these very narrow solution spaces and looks at ways we can get multiple values off of these important resources that the state has.
Representative?
More of the same is not going to work. I mean, we have a governor who's been here for three terms, and he says we need to figure out a way. Well, we need change. We don't need more of the same. We're not going to need four more years of the same. Kansas has 1% of their land mass controlled by the federal government, including post offices. Nebraska's 2%. Dakota, South Dakota, is 3%. Oregon's 53% of our land mass is controlled by the federal government. That's not acceptable. I believe that we need a governor who will be back in Washington, D.C., seeking to make changes. We're not going to get anywhere from going back to the Congress and just asking for more, or the president. We need to have a governor who will align with other Western governors who are in the same situation with their states and go to CNN and MSNBC and Fox News and make a national issue out of the fact that we have Americans in depression. We have a county in Oregon that's about to go insolvent. We have families that are like in the Depression. We have in Josephine County areas where there's no real law enforcement or very little. And we cannot continue with this. What we need is a governor who will be saying, when part of America is suffering, we all are suffering. And when the people get involved and when they see what's going on with the dysfunctional management that we have presently of our federal lands, it will make a difference. You know, is it going to work? You know, I'm not sure, but I know that I'm not going to sit by and do nothing any longer. Doing nothing is not working for Southern Oregon, Eastern Oregon, or Western Oregon on the coast. We have timber. We're watching it burn up. Right now, we have scales of files. We have fires. We have 20 fires just in Washington and Oregon right now. We even have to have an emergency call because it's so serious. We cannot continue more of the same. We need dynamic leadership where we go back to the federal government and we say enough is enough. The Western states need control over their lands.
Our next question comes from Larry Campbell. Representative, you answer first.
Thank you. Since nearly a third of Oregon voters declare themselves as nonpartisan, wouldn't an open primary be beneficial in terms of encouraging voter participation and in better representing voter preference for candidates?
You know, this whole issue about should we have an open primary, it's being done in other states. Once again, I think that we can learn from the experience in other states. There's strong partisans in both party that are firmly against this because they think it might lessen the power of their party. I don't agree with that. I think that we seriously should consider this. What it would do would be to drive the candidates that make it to the general election toward the middle. You wouldn't have just the extreme right or left controlling the primaries that thereby give us such a fight, and then after the election, it becomes so partisan. We can't do that. The open primary is a good idea. We ought to seriously look at it, and whatever the voters decide, I will enforce, because that's the oath I take, and I'm not going to change my mind just because I get elected and I decide maybe capital punishment shouldn't be enforced like the governor's done. I will enforce the laws the voters decide.
Governor?
Yes, I do support the open primary. I supported it in 2008, a similar measure that was on the ballot. It just seems to me that a political system that disenfranchises a third of the voters is not a very good political system. I understand that my party and Representative Richardson's party don't support it, but particularly in Washington, D.C., I think less so fortunately in Oregon, but in Washington, D.C., the purpose of political debate is about the acquisition and retention of partisan political power, not the use of that power to advance the common good. And I think I think that will bring the country down if we don't figure out a way to create some sense of community and common purpose in our nation. The inability to fund the Highway Transportation Fund is just such an example. That's the lifeblood of our economy. And that's not anything that anyone used to disagree on. And that's become just an utterly partisan issue. So, yes, I do support it. I think we've got to watch it. I mean, there may be some untoward consequences, but I do think that it's time.
Next question comes from Peter Wong. And, Governor, you answer first.
Given that Oregon's population is diversifying both racially and ethnically, what would you do to make state government more welcoming to these groups?
We have a very intentional effort going on in my office to make certainly my administration and our state agencies better reflect the nature of our population. We have really moved the dial in terms of appointments to boards and commissions. Over half are women. I think in the neighborhood of 30-plus are people of color, and we're continuing to move the dial on that. That's extraordinarily important. And we have a ongoing conversation that's led by Frank Garcia, who does diversity and inclusion for us with the state agencies on a regular basis, trying to build a pipeline of people to come in and actually join the ranks of state government. So extraordinarily important and remain deeply committed to reflecting that diversity in our public agencies and public institutions.
Representative?
I want to be the governor of 100% of the population and not a minor percent. 2% of the population is African American. I don't want to be a governor of 98% of the population, 100%. I believe that, and I look at the staff that the governor's got, it's amazing at the lack of diversity that is apparent there. I believe that all of our minority groups need to be represented. I want a cabinet where they're represented. I want to have their feelings and their thoughts and their traditions and their cultures to have an influence in decisions that are made. My wife and I are in Portland, and just the last couple of weeks, I've been attending some of the African-American churches on Sundays, actually two so far, and it's been fascinating because it's different from what I'm used to. In Southern Oregon, there's not a lot of diversity. I want very much to understand their issues. I want to know about the schools and what's going on in Eastern Portland. I think that the governor has a responsibility to get input from all cultures because that's going to be a major influence in the future. I mean, half of our kids, by the way, very soon, that are in school will be from minorities.
Follow-up from Peter. Governor, you answer first. A minute.
Okay, quick follow-up. How would you stand on the referendum on the driver's card law that was referred by opponents to the November ballot?
I strongly support Senate Bill 833. Its premise was to reduce the number of uninsured and unlicensed drivers on the road, but it was motivated by a much larger belief, and that is that every person in this state, regardless of the color of their skin, regardless of their home language, regardless of their gender, has an equal shot at the American dream. And by repealing that, we are going to basically create enormous problems for large portions of our minority Oregonians. It's reprehensible, and I will do all I can to make sure that that law stands. Not only that, it will have a devastating economic impact on large portions of our agricultural community, the nursery industry, for example, which is probably the single largest subpart of our agriculture budget. It's a human rights issue. It's an equity issue. It's an opportunity issue, and Senate Bill 833 should not be repealed.
Representative?
Well, I'm grateful that in Oregon we have the opportunity for people to have a voice in some of the laws that were being passed. I appreciate the passion that the governor has shown on it, except that that's not what is in the best interest of our state. I believe we should learn from the experiences of others. I did a newsletter, and some of you get the newsletter I send out. It goes to over 400,000 Oregonians. I didn't know which way to go on this. I explained the pros and cons and got feedback from the people. One of the readers said, "Do you know what's happened in Tennessee with this issue?" So they sent me a link. I read about it. Tennessee had passed a driver's card and then repealed it because they were finding busloads of illegal immigrants coming from as far away as Chicago to get a driver's card. I got a link from a reader that said, "Do you know what's going on in New Mexico?" I read the article. Susana Martinez, the governor there, said, "If there was a way for us to repeal this, we should do so, and I would do so, because we have a little over 60,000 illegal aliens in our state, and we've already issued over 90,000 driver's cards. It's not working out in other states. We should learn from their experiences and not just go forward because an individual thinks it's a good idea."
Time there. We have about 20, 25 minutes remaining for questions. Back to Dave Baker, and Representative, you answer first.
It's been a while since we've asked the voters to approve a sales tax. Probably a reason for that. They've rejected the sales tax 9 times in the last 80 years. Nonetheless, is it time once again to consider a sales tax or some kind of major tax restructuring overhaul for Oregonians?
I believe the governor represents all of the people, and the people have spoken on this 9 times. our current governor says, he had said in the past, listen, I supported a sales tax in the past, and I mean that's on the record, and I don't apologize for that. Well, okay, don't apologize for it, but to say we need a three-legged stool, why don't we learn from what's gone on in other states? You know, right now we have property tax and income tax. California has property tax, income tax, and a sales tax. So how is that three-legged stool working out for them? We can't just follow a path of getting more money. What we need to do is realize that our citizens have spoken, that we need to live within our means. We need to ensure that the money that we have been entrusted is being well spent. Government is not just getting through the next 2 years. There needs to be long-term planning. We need to be looking at every program and every agency we have and asking the question, if we didn't have this today, would we create it? And if the answer is no, then why are we continuing to fund it? We should take from it those key components that we need to maintain, put those in an agency or program that we will maintain, and then shut it down. There are programs and agencies that have lived beyond their usefulness, and yet we continue to fund them. We could redirect those resources to our highest priorities. We don't always need to be looking at how do you get more money. We need more taxpayers, not higher rates. We have a spending problem, not just a revenue problem.
The governor?
Well, you know, leadership is not just about looking somewhere else for answers. It's about providing answers, and Oregon has a long history of innovation and leadership. On the sales tax specifically, yes, I have supported the sales tax, not very successfully. I think the closest we got was 33% yes. But I still continue to believe that a state with a very narrow income tax-based system and a very high top marginal rate and a huge influx of tourists ought to have some kind of consumption tax. Having said that, I don't think it's politically feasible, and I'm not sure that's where we should put our energy. Now, as you know, I've been working with business and labor trying to build a coalition to look at the solution space for some kind of change in our revenue system. That's one of the reasons I got the ballot measures off this last time. And I've learned some things in the process. I've learned, one, that it would be very, very difficult to pass a sales tax. Secondly, I've learned that we have some definitional problems. For some people, tax reform means just a lot more money for important public services. For other people, it means lowering the top rate and perhaps doing some kind of a targeted capital gains tax reduction for Oregon investment. We need to remember that our tax code is a means to an end, and the end is to provide adequate resources for important public services like education. It's to make sure the incentives are aligned with the economic activity and job creation we want in the next 20 years, not the last 20 years. And it's trying to remove those barriers that prevent low-wage workers from moving up the income ladder. I will continue to explore those possibilities with the Business Labor Coalition, with legislators and other stakeholders, and bring recommendations to the 2015 legislature. But I also think it's important to look not just at how we raise public resources, but how we spend them, which is what's guided our approach to healthcare. By redesigning the delivery mechanism to get better results with lower dollars. It's how we've approached our changes to education. It's how we've approached our changes to public safety to prevent building the new prison for another $600 million, and it's what guided our approaches to our public retirement system.
Our next question comes from Therese Bottomley. Governor, you answer first.
Okay.
Well, speaking of PERS, how should the state respond if the Supreme Court throws out the reforms adopted in 2013?
Well, I think that if indeed that happens, and I don't expect it to happen, I think the options are extraordinarily limited. I mean, the court has built up a body of case law around the public employees retirement system, and I think probably the only window through which we could have addressed this issue was to modify the cost of living adjustment. We didn't take a benefit away. We were just everyone still gets the increase every year, but it's been modified. So, you know, this was obviously a very contentious issue. I just want to say that it's important to recognize that this is not about public employees. We've got great, hardworking public employees, and these benefits were earned, sometimes in lieu of wages. But because of the crash of the stock market, we were in a situation where the crisis in school funding and the crisis in funding important public services had become not just a revenue problem but also a cost problem. So I think we did the responsible thing. I think that we're pretty much at the end of the road if the Supreme Court decides that this doesn't meet constitutional muster.
Representative?
The governor, in his grand bargain, had secret conversations taking place out of the presence of the people and most of the legislators, and they came up with a deal, and the deal didn't solve the PERS problem, although that seemed to be what was represented. What it did is merely lessen the increase in the PERS costs, and we're scheduled for additional increases in the next 2 years and the years after that. How do we deal with this? We need to first accept the fact that we're going to honor the contract that we have with our retirees. But what are the provisions of that contract? The legislature has passed little tweaks and changes in PERS over 3 decades, and during that time, it has not just signed into additional contractual provisions, but it's given additional ability to spike the final calculation for the annuities and other things like that. What needs to happen is we need, as the legislature and the governor, to get together, develop a bill that puts everything that is being discussed into one bill. It needs to go to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court will then have the responsibility to decipher it and say, this is contractual, this is not. We can't just keep tweaking around the edges on this. Let's determine what is contractual, what is not, and then make the changes necessary so that those things that are just largesse from the legislature get changed and that those contractual provisions are honored and we have to adjust accordingly with the results of that outcome. And it's not going to be easy.
The next question comes from Carrie Borgen. Representative, you answer first.
There's been a lot of discussion with the goals of 40-40-20 about funding being provided for students and student access to higher education. However, small universities and community colleges are struggling now providing services and infrastructure. How would you address this, being able to provide the adequate funding to meet those 40-40-20 goals for our small colleges and community colleges?
The 40-40-20 plan was an aspiration, although it's being treated as if it's hard law. One of the first things I heard from the universities after it was passed was, we're going to need to have tremendous amounts of more money because we look at the demographics, and for us to achieve this goal, we're going to have to grossly increase the capacity to have education presented as it's been presented for the last 150 years. What we're going to need to do to align ourselves with or to adjust so that we can have affordable, accessible college and university availability for our students is to change the priorities. We now, we pay lip service to improving the quality of education, but the vast majority of our expenditures and the increases in expenditures is going to the social service programs, especially to healthcare. And the governor's talked about how we've got 300,000 more people covered. Yes, we have no new doctors to present the coverage, to provide that access, but the focus is always seems to be on healthcare. I understand, he's a doctor. But what we really need to do is to say, is education important? Is the rising generation the key to our future? Do we have a direct connection between education and a force that's prepared to compete in jobs in our global economy? If so, education needs to be a higher priority. We need to fund our education budgets first and not last. And we need to make sure that the expenditures in the colleges are focusing on classrooms and providing education and not being diverted in overly for administration and other expenses.
Governor?
Well, first of all, we did institute the first tuition freeze in about a decade during this last session, and I would think we need to continue to move in that direction. I think there's a huge role for online learning that's actually being worked on in a number of places. Again, the Eastern Promise is expanding the opportunities. They're doing the same thing over in La Grande. So that's changing sort of the business model of how we provide post-secondary education. I do think their cost structure needs to be much more transparent than it is, and I think these new institutional boards are asking the right questions. So when someone tells you from the university that we need to charge X amount for credit hour, the question back is how much does it cost you to provide a credit hour? So there's a very opaque cost structure in those universities, and I think that the institutional boards are going to actually help that. Thirdly, there needs to be a clearer mission, particularly for our regional universities. They are not going to be all things to all people. They need to reflect, in my view, certainly a liberal arts base, but I think they need to look at the areas of expertise that are important to Southern Oregon, let's say if you're talking about SOU or Eastern Oregon. So we need to have a much more focused and aligned function of our whole post-secondary system, which is really what the OAIB is about. It's trying to align governance, funding, and policy around outcomes. I also think that in terms of tuition, The treasurer's proposal is intriguing to me. One might consider capitalizing that more by making it a matching program if it should pass. A lot of the folks that are raising big dollars for our universities, I think, are also concerned about access to those universities. So I think there's not a silver bullet. I would say it's more silver buckshot. But I do think that the regionals and our community colleges play a huge role, particularly our community colleges, in reentry to the workforce. And I guess the last thing I would add is the fundamental changes we're making in Oregon's workforce system, I think, will help that by better aligning our workforce system with our community colleges and our regional universities.
Our next question comes from Larry Campbell. Governor, you answer first.
Secure Rural Schools Act 2000, intended to offset the loss of timber revenues on federal lands. For a number of years, the counties have seen reduced payments with every congressional reauthorization. Cuts have been especially hard on counties that have used this money to pay for public safety, for schools. What needs to be done to address these deficits created by the changes in federal forest policies? What role will you play in that solution?
Well, I obviously played a very active role in the O&C issue. I convened a panel last fall with leading representatives of the timber industry, the environmental community, and the counties to try to figure out an approach that we could take back to Congress. We did not achieve consensus, but we did lay out a set of principles that are now embedded both in the DeFazio bill and the Wyden bill. And as I said, I'm having weekly calls with the senator and the congressman. This bill, we hope, will be marked up by the end of the month. And we'll address some certainty of timber supply and revenue flowing to the counties. Obviously, it's got to pass and it's got to be signed by the president, but I've been deeply involved in the whole O&C question. I think there's a larger issue, though, and that I touched on that earlier. It's sort of federal forest management reform. I mean, it is an incredible bureaucracy. It's set up right now so that forest health treatments are reduced because we have to fight fires. And then that uses up money that can't go in and do the treatments that would prevent the fires in the first place. So one of the reasons I agreed to serve as the chair of the Western Governors Association is because that's, to me, the next big thing, is to look at the West and Intermountain West and all these states, which have a huge amount of federal land on them, and ask ourselves a bunch of fundamental questions about how we change the management paradigm, how we streamline the appeals process, how we provide certainty both for conservation gains and for forest health treatments. And so I think those are the two elements. One, we'll hopefully get some results on this year. The second one is something that I hope we can make some progress on over the next couple of years.
Representative?
I think it's begging the question to say, let's just keep going back to Congress and asking them to do something. It hasn't happened. They have interests back there that are contrary to the interests out here. We need to take bold and decisive action. We need a governor to be the spokesperson for the state. I mean, once I went to, I contacted one of the agencies back there, and I explained what we needed to do, and he said, Representative, there are thousands of assemblymen and representatives and legislators throughout this country, but we pay attention to 50 representatives of the people, and those are the governors. We need a governor who will align with other governors and go back, as I mentioned before, and make this a national issue. We have, you know, timber everywhere, but people are still unemployed in a natural resource state because they can't utilize the harvest of those trees that are 50, 60, 70 years old that were replanted after the last harvest. We have more timber standing now than we had in 1900. We can do this without abusing the environment. We need healthy forests and healthy communities, and that's going to come by changing the national attitude toward what we're talking about doing, toward our timber policy. We need a governor who, will align with other governors and make this a national issue and gain public support across this country so that we don't have Americans in Oregon who are in depression state because of the failure of Congress and the president to take action. People, our leaders, whether it's in the state or in the federal capital, respond to the outcry of the people. And until this becomes an issue of the people nationally, because we have Americans in Oregon who are in depression, there's not going to be a change. I will lead that charge. I will be in Washington, D.C. I'm not going to be there, just my hands out saying, please, more gruel. I mean, just begging to get more money from the taxes that we send there. We need leadership. We need a change in viewpoint, and we need it now.
The next question comes from Peter Wong. Representative, you answer first.
Given that SAFE, the largest provider of worker compensation insurance in Oregon, is a quasi-public corporation not directly under the governor's control, is there a role for the governor in the current situation involving its chief executive?
Absolutely. Anytime we create a kind of a quasi-public organization that has specific monopolistic responsibilities but doesn't get oversight, we're setting the stage for abuse and for failure. The state needs to be doing a full audit of SAFE. We need to be carefully going through how it's being functioned or how it's being administered and what changes need to be made in its charter to ensure that the payments, the money that's being sent by employees all across the state are being adequately and fairly and legally be utilized. I think that only the state is going to be able to do that.
Governor?
Well, in the case of SAFE, you have a problem between the board and an agency. If it appears to me that that management problem is bleeding over into affecting the effectiveness of our workers' compensation system, I would jump in with both feet. That is not the case at this particular point. I was involved in the original changes with SAFE. It had saved probably $17 billion for employers over the last 20 years, and the workers' comp system continues to function adequately. I'm monitoring it very, very closely, but one of the, I think, responsibilities of this job is know when to jump in and when not to jump in. Cover Oregon was not fulfilling its basic mission, and I did jump in. That's not the case with SAFE yet, and I don't believe it's that we micromanage these agencies. Now, I do have three appointments coming up to SAFE, and this will be a conversation that I'll have with the candidates. This is a board dispute with the agency itself, and at this point, it does not appear that that has had any negative impact on the ability of that agency to administer one of the best workers' compensation systems in the United States.
Our last question today comes from Dave Baker of the Register Guard.
Methamphetamine continues to be a serious problem in the state of Oregon. A few years ago, we tried to deal with it by making it more difficult to create the drug itself, but the legal system continues to see methamphetamine as a root cause for so many of the cases that go through there. Is there anything that further that can be done to deal with this problem?
Well, I don't offer you a silver bullet for the methamphetamine problem, but I think there are two elements. We obviously have to figure out a better way to provide adequate law enforcement, because I think that's one of the problems, particularly in my old stomping ground, where you don't have a lot of law enforcement. It becomes a sort of a magnet for people who are conducting a wide variety of illicit activities, and I think that's one of the real challenges we're going to have to find in the upcoming legislative session, which gets to the public safety issue we've already talked about. I think we have to get at root causes, and there's a direct relationship between poverty kids who basically don't have a clear pathway forward to a successful career and the use of substances, whether it's methamphetamine or anything else. There's also a direct relationship to crime. So addressing poverty is, I think, the fundamental approach. And, you know, we have been pursuing, and the First Lady has been helping lead the Prosperity Initiative, which is designed to try to get at the root causes of poverty. Our early learning system and the interventions and family supports for struggling kids and families is a direct effort to address the root causes of poverty and make sure all these kids get to kindergarten ready to learn, are reading at third grade, and actually have a shot and some hope for finding a job and being a full, productive, and contributing citizen. So anyone who tells you there's a quick snap result of this just doesn't get it. But we do have to have the discipline and the commitment to recognize that if we're not willing to invest on the front end, if we're not willing to give our children an opportunity at the American dream, an opportunity to move up, then we're going to have a lot of hemorrhage, a lot of loss of human potential, which is really what methamphetamine takes out of our society.
Representative?
I once asked a young guy why he does drugs, and he said, man, it's chemical relief. And it's an escape. It is a direct cause or direct result from a breakdown in family, from poverty, from not having a job. We can address this problem primarily by changing the circumstances in our state. It needs to be an economic change and an educational change. We have this high unemployment that's been higher than the national average for 17 or 18 years. We have the current situation where Oregon has lost 4,300 jobs in the last week, in the last month, and the federal government has increased by 288,000 jobs. If you want to solve the drug problem, one of the most important things you can do is to help lift people out of poverty by providing an environment where people can get a decent job. Families need that. We need to take action to restore a vibrant economy where people can get a decent education and have an option to work. Right now, I mean, I've got a large family. Four of my kids have been exported to other states because they couldn't get a decent job in Oregon. We need to be exporting our services and projects and products to other states and other countries, which creates a growth in our gross domestic product. That creates greater demand for services and products. That creates jobs. I think the best thing that we can do at this point to help with the drug problem is to change the economy and change our education system. That means jobs and the money to fund education.
And let's move to our closing statements, which will be delivered in reverse order of how our opening statements went. It means, Representative Richardson, you have the floor first.
You know, with all due respect, talk is cheap. Promises made are one thing, but we have a track record that has to be looked at, and promises broken are what we see in that record. Our governor no longer has the passion to serve, and it's hurting our state. We've watched as he has become more aloof and more out of touch. We've seen it in his lack of oversight on state projects like Cover Oregon and the Columbia River Crossing, and in wrong-headed decisions like hiring Rudy Crewe to fix our education system and failing to hire a systems integrator to oversee Cover Oregon. And while Oregon and our economy lagged, and while we were in legislative session, he flies across the world to study gross national happiness in Bhutan. I mean, you can't make this stuff up. We need to have a governor who pays attention to what's going on in our state. I mean, he spent more time in Bhutan than he has with either of our largest foreign trade partners. Foreign trade is a key to Oregon's prosperity engine. I've organized and conducted 10 trade missions to China. China is our number one trade partner. During that time, exports have quadrupled. And although I can't take all the credit for that, I have developed long-term relationships with our trade partners overseas, and that's resulted in creating jobs here in Oregon. More than 40% of Oregon's products are exports, are being exported to the Asian companies and Asian countries. And we have the potential to double that with the right kind of leadership. When you sell goods and services, the demand creates new jobs for Oregon workers. For instance, let me tell you the story of an Ashland company called Air Rescue Systems. ARS teaches helicopter pilots and crews how to perform rescues in difficult urban and rural settings. A few years ago, they were struggling to get contracts for aviation training with large departments in Chinese cities. ARS joined one of our trade delegations. We went to China, and the rest is history. They obtained multiple contracts, each worth more than $1 million, and have trained scores of Chinese aviators with their world-class air rescue techniques. Before we went to China, ARS had 15 employees. Today, they have 60 employees. That is how good-paying jobs are created, by marketing Oregon's products and services abroad. And it takes time, commitment, and leadership. Oregon needs a governor who will be an ambassador for Oregon businesses. Oregon's prosperity engine runs on two things, a strong economy and a world-class education system. Lately, it's been firing on only a part of its cylinders. And it's no wonder. The governor's been AWOL. And when he is here, he's distracted. It's time to prioritize a healthy economy and a robust public education system. Oregon's 49th in the nation in its graduation rate, and Common Core, the newest federal mandate, will result in even fewer of our students graduating. He supports Common Core, I do not. As governor, I will implement a moratorium on Common Core until it's ready for implementation. Like many government programs, Common Core sounds good, but the devil is always in the details. Forcing Common Core on Oregon schools before it's been properly vetted is turning our teachers into class monitors, and some of our best teachers are giving up and leaving the profession. Teachers should be allowed to teach. We need more local control, parents and teachers making decisions affecting our children's education, not federal bureaucrats. We must provide equal educational opportunity for all of our children, and that's both in academics and in the trades. I'd like to tell you a story about a carpentry program in Sabin-Schulenburg High School that's in Milwaukee, but I can't because they don't have one. The carpentry room there at Sabin is filled with tools and materials, but it's dark and it's empty. The Carpenters Union, which runs its own alternative high school program, would be thrilled to staff the one at Sabin, but they're not allowed. We need to embrace common sense reforms that focus on the students and not the status quo. I believe every Oregon problem we face is going to be solved successfully and is being solved successfully somewhere. I've mentioned that many times. We don't have to start with a blank piece of paper. Let's learn from the experiences of others. Together, we have the passion and the purpose, and we can answer all of our challenges. Together, we can restore our state. This isn't a campaign. It's a movement to me. Together, we can move our state out of the shadows and into the brighter days, the days of a new era for us. We, with proper leadership, Oregon's best days are truly ahead. We can change the course of our state's future. We can do this if we work together. Let's do it.
Governor?
January 2011 was a sobering and humbling moment in Oregon's history. We had a choice to make. We could stand together and take on the economic and budget and political challenges that we faced, or we could allow our differences to define us and tear us apart. We chose to work together, agreeing on a vision and a plan for getting Oregonians back to work, rebuilding a world-class education system from early childhood to post-secondary education and training, and taking on the growing cost of health care and public safety and our retirement system, not just to contain costs, but to more effectively serve Oregonians and to change the long-term trajectory of our state. Since the day I took office in 2011, I have been focused on putting Oregonians back to work and creating a more sustainable foundation for our state, and I'm very proud of the progress that we've made. When I look at the next 4 years, I think about 3 days last fall. When the legislature adjourned in July of 2013, many school districts were still facing teacher layoffs and shortened school days. Tuition increases were still preventing far too many Oregonians from getting the education and training they needed to enter or re-enter the workforce. I thought that we could do better. So 2 weeks after the legislature adjourned, I embarked on a very interesting summer, traveling across the state without my fly rod, I might add, talking to legislators and business and labor leaders and school boards and local governments with the idea of coming back in the fall and calling a special session to raise revenue, to further reduce the cost of our public retirement system, to provide tax relief for small businesses, and to reinvest, particularly in education, but also in mental health and in services for senior citizens. I called that session on September 30th in the backdrop of the growing chaos and dysfunction in Washington, D.C. The next day, on October 1st, the U.S. Congress shut down the federal government. And the next day, on October 2nd, the legislature passed every one of those bills with bipartisan votes. Now, that's really what this job is about, the ability to find and hold that operational political center that we've been talking about today, setting a vision for Oregon and then bringing Oregonians together as Oregonians in common cause to achieve a common purpose. To me, the implications of our success during that special session go to the very heart of self-governance, and it speaks to who we are, it speaks to how we want to treat one another, it speaks to how we're going to do the people's business. I think the people of this state and the people around the nation yearn for some sign that their public institutions can move beyond polarization and partisanship and the gridlock of ideology and act in the larger public interest. In 3 days last fall, Oregon set an example for ourselves, and I think set an example for the nation. I've been doing this a long time. For me, it started in 1968 when Robert Kennedy was running for president, which was to be his last campaign. And that was a campaign about equity and opportunity. It was a campaign about unrepresented farm workers in California. It was a campaign about poverty and children starving to death in the Delta of Mississippi and on the Pine Ridge Indian Reservation in the wealthiest nation in the world. It was a campaign that asked profound and often unpleasant and disturbing questions about who we were as a nation, about our values, about how we wanted to treat one another as Americans and as fellow human beings. It was that last campaign that lasted only 82 days from the moment he announced until he was assassinated in Los Angeles that inspired me and motivated me to contribute most of my adult life to public service. This is my last campaign. And if I get elected, I will leave office at the end of 2018, exactly 50 years after Bobby Kennedy's last campaign. And I often ask myself, what do I want to show for all those years? And it's really pretty simple. I want to know that I helped, in my own small way, create an enduring prosperity for Oregonians. Now, I've learned some things over my years of public service. First, I've learned that Oregon will not be a good place for any of us to live unless it's a good place for all of us to live. And I've also learned that rebuilding an enduring prosperity is about more than just creating jobs and just improving our quarterly revenue forecasts. It's about rebuilding a strong and secure middle class with a deep commitment to equity and opportunity for everyone. It's about not just creating jobs, but creating jobs with benefits, creating jobs that reward hard work with the opportunity to move up and not just get by, and a workforce that has the training and the skills to secure those jobs. It's about cleaner air and cleaner water and an economy that protects our natural resources and reduces our carbon footprint. Now, I know we're never going to reach that vision in the next 4 years or in the next 10 years even, but working together, we can continue to make progress and change our trajectory for a brighter future. Doing so requires that we build on the progress we've already made, that we hold on and maintain that operational political center, and that we more deeply root in our civic culture a commitment to view each other not as partisans and stakeholders, but as neighbors and friends and citizens working to make Oregon a better place for all of us to live. Thank you.
Ladies and gentlemen, our time is up. On behalf of the Oregon Newspaper Publishers Association, join me in thanking Governor Kitzhaber and Representative Richardson for their time today. So that we can prepare for our next speaker, our next session, we ask audience members to leave the room, exit into the gallery area to your back. Thanks again to all of you, our participants, our panel members. We'll see you back here at noon for our session with Attorney General.